outcomes available. To characterize the thinking style of superforecasters, Tetlock uses the phrase perpetual beta, a term used by computer programmers for a program that is not meant to be released in a final version, but that is endlessly used, analyzed, and improved. Tetlock finds that the strongest predictor of rising into the ranks of superforecasters is perpetual beta, the degree to which one is committed to belief updating and self-improvement. As he puts it, what makes them so good is less what they are than what they do. The hard work of research, the careful thought and self-criticism, the gathering and synthesizing of other perspectives, the granular judgments, and relentless updating. They like a particular cycle of thinking. Try, fail, analyze, adjust, try again. Noise and bias in forecasting. At this point, you might be tempted to think that people can be trained to be super forecasters, or at least to perform more like them. And indeed, Tetlock and his collaborators have worked to do exactly that. Their efforts should be considered the second stage of understanding why super forecasters perform so well, and how to make them perform better. In an important study, Tetlock and his team randomly assigned regular, non-super forecasters to three groups, in which they tested the effect of different interventions on the quality of subsequent judgments. These interventions exemplify three of the strategies we have described to improve judgments. 1. Training. Several forecasters completed a tutorial designed to improve their abilities by teaching them probabilistic reasoning. In the tutorial, the forecasters learned about various biases, including base rate neglect, overconfidence, and confirmation bias. The importance of averaging multiple predictions from diverse sources and considering reference classes. 2. Teaming, a form of aggregation. Some forecasters were asked to work in teams in which they could see and debate one another's predictions. Teaming could increase accuracy by encouraging forecasters to deal with opposing arguments and to be actively open-minded. 3. Selection. All forecasters were scored for accuracy, and at the end of a full year, the top 2% were designated as super forecasters, and given the opportunity to work together in elite teams the following year. As it turns out, all three interventions worked, in the sense that they improved people's Brier scores. Training made a difference, teaming made a larger one, and selection had an even larger effect. This important finding confirms the value of aggregating judgments and selecting good judges. But it is not the full story. Armed with data about the effects of each intervention, Vilas Atopa, who collaborated with Tetlock and Mellers, developed a sophisticated statistical technique to tease out how exactly each intervention improved forecasts. In principle, he reasoned, there are three major reasons why some forecasters can perform better or worse than others. 1. They can be more skilled at finding and analyzing data in the environment that are relevant to the prediction they have to make. This explanation points to the importance of information. 2. Some forecasters may have a general tendency to err on a particular side of the true value of a forecast. If, out of hundreds of forecasts, you systematically overestimate or underestimate the probability that certain changes from the status quo will occur, you can be said to suffer from a form of bias, in favor of either change or stability. 3. Some forecasters may be less susceptible to noise or random errors. In forecasting, as in any judgment, noise can have many triggers. Forecasters may overreact to a particular piece of news. This is an example of what we have called pattern noise. They may be subject to occasion noise, or they may be noisy in their use of the probability scale. All these errors and many more are unpredictable in their size and direction. Satopa, Tetlock, Mellers, and their colleague, Murat Salikov, called their model the BIN, Bias, Information, and Noise model for forecasting. They set out to measure how much each of the three components was responsible for the performance improvement in each of the three interventions. Their answer was simple. All three interventions worked primarily by reducing noise. As the researchers put it, whenever an intervention boosted accuracy, it worked mainly by suppressing random errors in judgment. Curiously, the original intent of the training intervention was to reduce bias. Since the training was designed to reduce biases, a less-than-super-forecaster would have predicted that bias reduction would be the major effect of the training. Yet the training worked by reducing noise. The surprise is easily explained. Tetlock's training is designed to fight psychological biases. As you now know, the effect of psychological biases is not always a statistical bias. When they affect different individuals on different judgments in different ways, psychological biases produce noise. This is clearly the case here, as the events being forecast are quite varied. The same biases can lead a forecaster to overreact or underreact depending on the topic. We should not expect them to produce a statistical bias, defined as the general tendency of a forecaster to believe that events will happen or not happen. As a result, training forecasters to fight their psychological biases works by reducing noise. Teaming had a comparably large effect on noise reduction, but it also significantly improved the ability of the teams to extract information. This result is consistent with the logic of aggregation. Several brains that work together are better at finding information than one is. If Alice and Brian are working together and Alice has spotted signals that Brian has missed, their joint forecast will be better. When working in groups, the super forecasters seem capable of avoiding the dangers of group polarization and information cascades. Instead, they pool their data and insights and, in their actively open-minded way, make the most of the combined information. Satopa and his colleagues explain this advantage. Teaming, unlike training, allows forecasters to harness the information. Selection had the largest total effect. Some of the improvement comes from a better use of information. Super forecasters are better than others at finding relevant information, possibly because they are smarter, more motivated, and more experienced at making these kinds of forecasts than is the average participant. But the main effect of selection is, again, to reduce noise. Super forecasters are less noisy than regular players or even trained teams. This finding, too, was a surprise to Satopa and the other researchers. Super forecasters may owe their success more to superior discipline in tamping down measurement error than to incisive readings of the news that others cannot replicate. Where selection and aggregation work. The success of the super forecasting project highlights the value of two decision hygiene strategies. Selection, the super forecasters are, well, super, and aggregation. When they work in teams, forecasters perform better. The two strategies are broadly applicable in many judgments. Whenever possible, you should aim to combine the strategies by constructing teams of judges, for example, forecasters, investment professionals, recruiting officers, who are selected for being both good at what they do and complementary to one another. So far, we have considered the improved precision that is achieved by averaging multiple independent judgments, as in the Wisdom of Crowds experiments. Aggregating the estimates of higher validity judges will further improve accuracy. Yet another gain in accuracy can be obtained by combining judgments that are both independent and complementary. Imagine that four people are witnesses to a crime. It is essential, of course, to make sure that they do not influence one another. If, in addition, they have seen the crime from four different angles, the quality of the information they provide will be much better. The task of assembling a team of professionals to make judgments together resembles the task of assembling a battery of tests to predict the future performance of candidates at school or on the job. The standard tool for that task is multiple regression, introduced in Chapter 9. It works by selecting variables in succession. The test that best predicts the outcome is selected first. However, the next test to be included is not necessarily the second most valid. Instead, it is the one that adds the most predictive power to the first test by providing predictions that are both valid and not redundant with the first. For example, suppose you have two tests of mental aptitude which correlate 0.5 and 0.45 with future performance, and a test of personality that correlates only 0.3 with performance but is uncorrelated with aptitude tests. The optimal solution is to pick the more valid aptitude test first, then the personality test, which brings more new information. Similarly, if you are assembling a team of judges, you should of course pick the best judge first. But your next choice may be a moderately valid individual who brings some new skill to the table rather than a more valid judge who is highly similar to the first one. A team selected in this manner will be superior because the validity of pooled judgments increases faster when the judgments are uncorrelated with one another than when they are redundant. Pattern noise will be relatively high in such a team because individual judgments of each case will differ. Paradoxically, the average of that noisy group will be more accurate than the average of a unanimous one. An important caveat is in order. Regardless of diversity, aggregation can only reduce noise if judgments are truly independent. As our discussion of noise in groups has highlighted, group deliberation often adds more error in bias than it removes in noise. Organizations that want to harness the power of diversity must welcome the disagreements that will arise when team members reach their judgments independently. Eliciting and aggregating judgments that are both independent and diverse will often be the easiest, cheapest, and most broadly applicable decision hygiene strategy. Speaking of selection and aggregation, let's take the average of four independent judgments. This is guaranteed to reduce noise by half. We should strive to be in perpetual beta, like the superforecasters. Before we discuss the situation, what is the relevant base rate? We have a good team, but how can we ensure more diversity of opinions? Chapter 22. Guidelines in Medicine. Some years ago, a good friend of ours, let's call him Paul, was diagnosed with high blood pressure by his primary care doctor. We will call him Dr. Jones. The doctor advised Paul to try medication. Dr. Jones prescribed a diuretic, but it had no effect. Paul's blood pressure remained high. A few weeks later, Dr. Jones responded with a second medication, a calcium channel blocker. Its effect was also modest. These results baffled Dr. Jones. After 3 months of weekly office visits, Paul's high blood pressure readings had dropped slightly, but they were still too high. It wasn't clear what the next steps would be. Paul was anxious and Dr. Jones was troubled, not least because Paul was a relatively young man in good health. Dr. Jones contemplated trying a third medication. At that point, Paul happened to move to a new city where he consulted a new primary care doctor. We will call him Dr. Smith. Paul told Dr. Smith the story of his continuing struggles with high blood pressure. Dr. Smith immediately responded, "Buy a home blood pressure kit and see what the readings are. I don't think you have high blood pressure at all. You probably just have white coat syndrome. Your blood pressure goes up in doctor's offices." Paul did as he was told, and sure enough, his blood pressure was normal at home. It has been normal ever since, and a month after Dr. Smith told him about white coat syndrome, it became normal in doctor's offices as well. A central task of doctors is to make diagnoses, to decide whether a patient has some kind of illness, and if so, to identify it. Diagnosis often requires some kind of judgment. For many conditions, the diagnosis is routine and largely mechanical, and rules and procedures are in place to minimize noise. It's usually easy for a doctor to determine whether someone has a dislocated shoulder or a broken toe. Something similar can be said about problems that are more technical. Quantifying tendon degeneration produces little noise. When pathologists evaluate core needle biopsies of breast lesions, their evaluations are relatively straightforward, with little noise. Importantly, some diagnoses do not involve judgment at all. Healthcare often progresses by removing the element of judgment, by shifting from judgment to calculation. For strep throat, a doctor will begin with a rapid antigen test on a swab sample from a patient's throat. In a short period, the test can detect strep bacteria. Without the rapid antigen result, and to some extent even with it, there is a noise in diagnosis of strep throat. If you have a fasting blood sugar level of 126 milligrams per deciliter or higher, or an HbA1c, an average measure of blood sugar over the prior 3 months, of at least 6.5, you are considered to have diabetes. During the early stages of the COVID-19 pandemic, some doctors initially made diagnoses as a result of judgments reached after considering symptoms. As the pandemic progressed, testing became much more common, and the tests made judgment unnecessary. Many people know that when doctors do exercise judgment, they can be noisy and they might err. A standard practice is to advise patients to get a second opinion. In some hospitals, a second opinion is even mandatory. Whenever the second opinion diverges from the first, we have noise, though of course it may not be clear which doctor has it right. Some patients, including Paul, have been astonished to see how much the second opinion diverges from the first. But the surprise is not the existence of noise in the medical profession. It is its sheer magnitude. Our goals in this chapter are to elaborate that claim and to describe some of the approaches to noise reduction used by the medical profession. We will focus on one decision hygiene strategy: the development of diagnostic guidelines. We are keenly aware that an entire book could easily be written about noise in medicine and the various steps that doctors, nurses, and hospitals have been taking by way of remedy. Notably, noise in medicine is hardly limited to noise in diagnostic judgments, which is our focus here. Treatments can also be noisy, and an extensive literature addresses this topic as well. If a patient has a heart problem, doctors' judgments about the best treatment are shockingly variable. Whether the question involves the right medication, the right kind of surgery, or whether to get surgery at all. The Dartmouth Atlas Project has dedicated itself for more than 20 years to documenting glaring variations in how medical resources are distributed and used in the United States. Similar conclusions hold in numerous nations. For our purposes, however, a brief exploration of noise in diagnostic judgments will be sufficient. A tour of the horizon. There is an immense literature on noise in medicine. While much of the literature is empirical, testing for the presence of noise, much of it is also prescriptive. Those involved in healthcare are continuing to search for noise reduction strategies, which take many forms and are a goldmine of ideas worth considering in many fields. When there is noise, one physician may be clearly right, and the other may be clearly wrong, and may suffer from some kind of bias. As might be expected, skill matters a lot. A study of pneumonia diagnoses by radiologists, for instance, found significant noise. Much of it came from differences in skill. More specifically, variation in skill can explain 44% of the variation in diagnostic decisions, suggesting that policies that improve skill perform better than uniform decision guidelines. Here as elsewhere, training and selection are evidently crucial to the reduction of error, and to the elimination of both noise and bias. In some specialties, such as radiology and pathology, doctors are well aware of the presence of noise. Radiologists, for example, call diagnostic variation their Achilles heel. It is not clear whether noise in the fields of radiology and pathology receives particular attention because there is truly more noise in these fields than in others, or simply because noise is more easily documented there. We suspect that ease of documentation may be more important. Clean, simple tests of noise, and sometimes error, are easier to conduct in radiology. For example, you can return to scans or slides to reevaluate a previous assessment. In medicine, between-person noise, or inter-rater reliability, is usually measured by the kappa statistic. The higher the kappa, the less noise. A kappa value of 1 reflects perfect agreement. A value of 0 reflects exactly as much agreement as you would expect between monkeys throwing darts onto a list of possible diagnoses. In some domains of medical diagnosis, reliability as measured by this coefficient has been found to be slight or poor, which means that noise is very high. It is often found to be fair, which is, of course, better, but which also indicates significant noise. On the important question of which drug-drug interactions are clinically significant, generalist physicians reviewing 100 randomly selected drug-drug interactions showed poor agreement. To outsiders and to many doctors, diagnosis of the various stages of kidney disease might seem relatively straightforward, but nephrologists show only slight to moderate agreement in their judgments about the meaning of standard tests used in the evaluation of patients with kidney disease. On the question of whether a breast lesion was cancerous, one study found only fair agreement among pathologists. In diagnosing breast proliferative lesions, agreement was again only fair. Agreement was also fair when physicians assessed MRI scans for the degree of spinal stenosis. It is worth pausing over these findings. We have said that in some domains, the level of noise in medicine is very low. But in some areas that are fairly technical, doctors are far from noise-free. Whether a patient will be diagnosed with a serious disease, such as cancer, might depend on a kind of lottery, determined by the particular doctor that she will see. Consider just a few other findings from the literature, drawn from areas in which the volume of noise seems especially noteworthy. We describe these findings not to give authoritative statements about the current state of medical practice, which continues to evolve and improve, in some cases rapidly, but to convey a general sense of the pervasiveness of noise, both in the relatively recent past and in the present. 1. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in both men and women in the United States. Coronary angiograms, a primary method used to test for heart disease, assess the degree of blockage in the heart's arteries in both acute and non-acute settings. In non-acute settings, when a patient presents with recurrent chest pain, treatment, such as stent placement, is often pursued if more than 70% of one or more arteries is found to be blocked. However, a degree of variability in interpreting angiograms has been documented, potentially leading to unnecessary procedures. An early study found that 31% of the time, physicians evaluating angiograms disagreed on whether a major vessel was more than 70% blocked. Despite widespread awareness by cardiologists of potential variability in reading angiograms, and despite continuing efforts and corrective steps, the problem has yet to be solved. 2. Endometriosis is a disorder in which endometrial tissue, normally lining the inside of the uterus, grows outside the uterus. The disorder can be painful and lead to fertility problems. It is often diagnosed through laparoscopy, in which a small camera is surgically inserted into the body. Digital videos of laparoscopies in 3 patients, 2 of whom had endometriosis of varying degrees of severity and 1 whom did not, were shown to 108 gynecological surgeons. The surgeons were asked to judge the number and location of endometriotic lesions. They disagreed dramatically, with weak correlations on both number and location. 3. Tuberculosis, TB, is one of the most widespread and deadly diseases worldwide. In 2016 alone, it infected more than 10 million people and killed almost 2 million. A widely used method for detecting TB is a chest X-ray, which allows examination of the lungs for the empty space caused by the TB bacteria. Variability in diagnosis of TB has been well documented for almost 75 years. Despite improvements over the decades, studies have continued to find significant variability in diagnosis of TB, with moderate or just fair inter-rater agreement. There is also variability in TB diagnoses between radiologists in different countries. 4. When pathologists analyzed skin lesions for the presence of melanoma, the most dangerous form of skin cancer, there was only moderate agreement. The 8 pathologists reviewing each case were unanimous or showed only one disagreement just 62% of the time. Another study at an oncology center found that the diagnostic accuracy of melanomas was only 64%, meaning that doctors misdiagnosed melanomas in one of every 3 lesions. A third study found that dermatologists at New York University failed to diagnose melanoma from skin biopsies 36% of the time. The authors of the study conclude that the clinical failure to diagnose melanoma correctly has grievous implications for survival of patients with that potentially fatal disease. 5. There is variability in radiologists' judgments with respect to breast cancer from screening mammograms. A large study found that the range of false negatives among different radiologists varied from 0%, the radiologist was correct every time, to greater than 50%. The radiologist incorrectly identified the mammogram as normal more than half of the time. Similarly, false positive rates ranged from less than 1% to 64%, meaning that nearly 2/3 of the time the radiologist said the mammogram showed cancer when cancer was not present. False negatives and false positives from different radiologists ensure that there is noise. These cases of interpersonal noise dominate the existing research, but there are also findings of occasion noise. Radiologists sometimes offer a different view when assessing the same image again, and thus disagree with themselves, albeit less often than they disagree with others. When assessing the degree of blockage in angiograms, 22 physicians disagreed with themselves between 63 and 92% of the time. In areas that involve vague criteria and complex judgments, intra-rater reliability, as it is called, can be poor. These studies offer no clear explanation of this occasion noise, but another study not involving diagnosis identifies a simple source of occasion noise in medicine, a finding worth bearing in mind for both patients and doctors. In short, doctors are significantly more likely to order cancer screenings early in the morning than late in the afternoon. In a large sample, the order rates of breast and colon screening tests were highest at 8 a.m. at 63.7%. They decreased throughout the morning to 48.7% at 11 a.m. They increased to 56.2% at noon, and then decreased to 47.8% at 5 p.m. It follows that patients with appointment times later in the day were less likely to receive guideline-recommended cancer screening. How can we explain such findings? A possible answer is that physicians almost inevitably run behind in clinic after seeing patients with complex medical problems that require more than the usual 20-minute slot. We already mentioned the role of stress and fatigue as triggers of occasion noise. See Chapter 7. And these elements seem to be at work here. To keep up with their schedules, some doctors skip discussions about preventive health measures. Another illustration of the role of fatigue among clinicians is the lower rate of appropriate hand washing during the end of hospital shifts. Hand washing turns out to be noisy, too. Less noisy doctors. The value of guidelines. It would be a major contribution not only to medicine, but also to human knowledge, to provide a comprehensive account of the existence and magnitude of noise in the context of different medical problems. We are unaware of any such account. We hope that it will be produced in the fullness of time, but even now, existing findings provided some clues. At one extreme, diagnosis for some problems and illnesses is essentially mechanical and allows no room for judgment. In other cases, the diagnosis is not mechanical but straightforward. Anyone with medical training is highly likely to reach the same conclusion. In still other cases, a degree of specialization, say among lung cancer specialists, will be sufficient to ensure that noise exists but is minimal. At the other extreme, some cases present a great deal of room for judgment, and the relevant criteria for diagnosis are so open-ended that noise will be substantial and difficult to reduce. As we will see, this is the case in much of psychiatry. What might work to reduce noise in medicine? As we mentioned, training can increase skill, and skill certainly helps. So does the aggregation of multiple expert judgments, second opinions, and so forth. Algorithms offer an especially promising avenue, and doctors are now using deep learning algorithms and artificial intelligence to reduce noise. For example, such algorithms have been used to detect lymph node metastases in women with breast cancer. The best of these have been found to be superior to the best pathologist. And, of course, algorithms are not noisy. Deep learning algorithms have also been used, with considerable success, for the detection of eye problems associated with diabetes. And AI now performs at least as well as radiologists do in detecting cancer from mammograms. Further advances in AI will probably demonstrate its superiority. The medical profession is likely to rely on algorithms more and more in the future. They promise to reduce both bias and noise, and to save lives and money in the process. But our emphasis here will be on human judgment guidelines, because the domain of medicine helpfully illustrates how they produce good or even excellent results in some applications, and more mixed results in others. Perhaps the most famous example of a guideline for diagnosis is the Apgar score, developed in 1952 by the obstetric anesthesiologist Virginia Apgar. Assessing whether a newborn baby is in distress used to be a matter of clinical judgment for physicians and midwives. Apgar's score gave them a standard guideline instead. The evaluator measures the baby's color, heart rate, reflexes, muscle tone, and respiratory effort, sometimes summarized as a backronym for Apgar's name: appearance, skin color, pulse, heart rate, grimace, reflexes, activity, muscle tone, and respiration, breathing rate and effort. In the Apgar test, each of these five measures is given a score of 0, 1, or 2. The highest possible total score is 10, which is rare. A score of 7 or above is considered indicative of good health. Table 3 on the bonus PDF includes more guidelines. Note that heart rate is the only strictly numerical component of the score, and that all the other items involve an element of judgment. But because the judgment is decomposed into individual elements, each of which is straightforward to assess, practitioners with even a modest degree of training are unlikely to disagree a great deal, and hence, Apgar scoring produces little noise. The Apgar score exemplifies how guidelines work and why they reduce noise. Unlike rules or algorithms, guidelines do not eliminate the need for judgment. The decision is not a straightforward computation. Disagreement remains possible on each of the components, and hence on the final conclusion. Yet guidelines succeed in reducing noise because they decompose a complex decision into a number of easier subjudgments on predefined dimensions. The benefits of this approach are clear when we view the problem in terms of the simple prediction models discussed in Chapter 9. A clinician making a judgment about a newborn's health is working from several predictive cues. Occasion noise might be at work. On one day but not another, or in one mood but not another, a clinician could pay attention to relatively unimportant predictors or ignore important ones. The Apgar score focuses the health professional on the five that are empirically known to matter. Then, the score provides a clear description of how to evaluate each cue, which greatly simplifies each cue-level judgment and hence reduces its noise. Finally, the Apgar score specifies how to weight the predictors mechanically to produce the overall judgment required, whereas human clinicians would otherwise differ on the weights they assign to the cues. A focus on the relevant predictors, simplification of the predictive model, and mechanical aggregation, all of these reduce noise. Analogous approaches have been used in many medical domains. One example is the CentOR score to guide diagnosis of strep throat. A patient is given 1 point for each of the following symptoms or signs, whose terms, like the Apgar score, constitute a backronym for the last name of Robert CentOR, who, with his colleagues, first summarized this guideline. Absence of a cough, presence of exudates, white patches on the back of throat, tender or swollen lymph nodes in the neck, and a temperature greater than 100.4 degrees. Depending on the number of points a patient is assigned, a throat swab to diagnose strep pharyngitis may be recommended. Assessment and scoring are relatively straightforward using this scale, which has effectively reduced the number of people undergoing unnecessary testing and treatment for strep throat. Similarly, guidelines have been developed for breast cancer diagnosis with the Breast Imaging Reporting and Data System, BI-RADS, which reduces noise in the interpretations of mammograms. One study found that BI-RADS increased inter-rater agreement on the assessments of mammograms, demonstrating that guidelines can be effective in reducing noise in an area where variability has been significant. In pathology, there have been many successful efforts to use guidelines for the same purpose. The depressing case of psychiatry. In terms of noise, psychiatry is an extreme case. When diagnosing the same patient using the same diagnostic criteria, psychiatrists frequently disagree with one another. For that reason, noise reduction has been a major priority for the psychiatric community since at least the 1940s. And as we will see, despite being constantly refined, guidelines have provided only modest help in reducing noise. A 1964 study involving 91 patients and 10 experienced psychiatrists found that the likelihood of an agreement between two opinions was just 57%. Another early study involving 426 state hospital patients diagnosed independently by two psychiatrists found agreement merely 50% of the time in their diagnosis of the kind of mental illness that was present. Yet another early study involving 153 outpatients found 54% agreement. In these studies, the source of the noise was not specified. Interestingly, however, some psychiatrists were found to be inclined to assign patients to specific diagnostic categories. For example, some psychiatrists were especially likely to diagnose patients with depression and others with anxiety. As we shall soon see, levels of noise continue to be high in psychiatry. Why is this? Specialists lack a single clear answer, which means that the explanations for noise are themselves noisy. The large set of diagnostic categories is undoubtedly one factor, but in a preliminary effort to answer that question, researchers asked one psychiatrist to interview a patient first, and then had a second psychiatrist conduct another interview after a short resting period. The two psychiatrists met afterward and, if they disagreed, discussed why they did so. One frequent reason was inconstancy of the physician. Different schools of thought, different training, different clinical experiences, different interview styles. While a clinician with developmental training might explain the hallucinatory experience as part of post-traumatic experience of past abuse, a different clinician with a biomedical orientation might explain the same hallucinations as part of a schizophrenic process. Such differences are examples of pattern noise. Beyond physician differences, however, the main reason for noise was inadequacy of the nomenclature. Such observations and widespread professional dissatisfaction with psychiatric nomenclature helped motivate the 1980 revision, the third edition, of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM-3. The manual included, for the first time, explicit and detailed criteria for diagnosing mental disorders, a first step in the direction of introducing diagnostic guidelines. DSM-3 led to a dramatic increase in the research on whether diagnoses were noisy. It also proved helpful in reducing noise, but the manual was far from a complete success. Even after a significant 2000 revision of the fourth edition, DSM-4, originally published in 1994, research showed that the level of noise remained high. On the one hand, Ahmed Abaraya and his colleagues conclude that the use of diagnostic criteria for psychiatric disorders has been shown to increase the reliability of psychiatric diagnoses. On the other hand, there continues to be a more serious risk that admissions of a single patient will reveal multiple diagnoses for the same patient. Another version of the manual, DSM-5, was released in 2013. The American Psychiatric Association had hoped that DSM-5 would reduce noise because the new edition relied on more objective, clearly scaled criteria. But psychiatrists continue to show significant noise. For example, Samuel Lieblich and his colleagues find that psychiatrists have a hard time agreeing on who does and does not have major depressive disorder. Field trials for DSM-5 found minimal agreement, which means that highly trained specialist psychiatrists under study conditions were only able to agree that a patient has depression between 4 and 15% of the time. According to some field trials, DSM-5 actually made things worse, showing increased noise in all major domains with some diagnoses, such as mixed anxiety depressive disorder, so unreliable as to appear useless in clinical practice. The major reason for the limited success of guidelines seems to be that, in psychiatry, the diagnostic criteria of some disorders are still vague and difficult to operationalize. Some guidelines reduce noise by decomposing judgment into criteria on which disagreement is reduced, but to the extent that such criteria are relatively open-ended, noise remains likely. With this point in mind, prominent proposals call for more standardized diagnostic guidelines. These include 1. Clarifying diagnostic criteria, moving away from vague standards, 2. Producing reference definitions of symptoms and their level of severity on the theory that when clinicians agree on the presence or absence of symptoms, they are more likely to agree on the diagnosis, and 3, using structured interviews of patients in addition to open conversation. One proposed interview guide includes 24 screening questions that allow for more reliable diagnosis of, for example, anxiety, depression, and eating disorders. These steps sound promising, but it is an open question to what extent they would succeed in reducing noise. In the words of one observer, the reliance on the patient's subjective symptoms, the clinician's interpretation of the symptoms, and the absence of objective measure, such as a blood test, implant the seeds of diagnostic unreliability of psychiatric disorders. In this sense, psychiatry may prove especially resistant to attempts at noise reduction. On that particular question, it is too soon to make a confident prediction. But one thing is clear. In medicine in general, guidelines have been highly successful in reducing both bias and noise. They have helped doctors, nurses, and patients, and greatly improved public health in the process. The medical profession needs more of them. Speaking of guidelines in medicine, among doctors, the level of noise is far higher than we might have suspected. In diagnosing cancer and heart disease, even in reading x-rays, specialists sometimes disagree. That means that the treatment a patient gets might be a product of a lottery. Doctors like to think that they make the same decision whether it's Monday or Friday or early in the morning or late in the afternoon. but it turns out that what doctors say and do might well depend on how tired they are. Medical guidelines can make doctors less likely to blunder at a patient's expense. Such guidelines can also help the medical profession as a whole because they reduce variability. Chapter 23. Defining the scale and performance ratings. Let's start with an exercise. Take three people you know. They might be friends or colleagues. Rate them on a scale of 1 to 5, where 1 is the lowest and 5 is the highest, in terms of three characteristics: kindness, intelligence, and diligence. Now ask someone who knows them well, your spouse, best friend, or closest colleague, to do the same thing with respect to the same three people. There is a good chance that on some of the ratings you and the other rater came up with different numbers. If you and your counterpart are willing, please discuss the reasons for the differences. You might find that the answer lies in how you used the scale, what we have called level noise. Perhaps you thought a 5 requires something truly extraordinary, whereas the other rater thought that it merely requires something unusually good, or perhaps you differed because of your differing views of the people being rated, your understanding of whether they are kind, and how exactly to define that virtue might be different from that of the other rater. Now imagine that for the three people you rated, a promotion or bonus is at stake. Suppose that you and the other rater are engaged in performance ratings at a company that values kindness, or collegiality, intelligence, and diligence. Would there be a difference between your ratings? Would it be as large as in the earlier exercise, even larger? However those questions are answered, differences in policies and scaling are likely to produce noise. And in fact, that is what is pervasively observed in performance ratings across organizational settings. A judgment task. In almost all large organizations, performance is formally evaluated on a regular basis. Those who are rated do not enjoy the experience. As one newspaper headline put it, "Study finds that basically every single person hates performance reviews." Every single person also knows, we think, that performance reviews are subject to both bias and noise. But most people do not know just how noisy they are. In an ideal world, evaluating people's performance would not be a judgment task. Objective facts would be sufficient to determine how well people are doing. But most modern organizations have little in common with Adam Smith's pin factory, in which every worker had a measurable output. What would that output be for a chief financial officer or for a head of research? Today's knowledge workers balance multiple, sometimes contradictory, objectives. Focusing on only one of them might produce erroneous evaluations and have harmful incentive effects. The number of patients a doctor sees every day is an important driver of hospital productivity, for example, but you would not want physicians to focus single-mindedly on that indicator, much less to be evaluated and rewarded only on that basis. Even quantifiable performance metrics, say sales for a salesperson or number of lines of code written for a programmer, must be evaluated in context. Not all customers are equally difficult to serve, and not all software development projects are identical. In light of these challenges, many people cannot be evaluated entirely on the basis of objective performance metrics. Hence the ubiquity of judgment-based performance reviews. One quarter signal, three quarters noise. Thousands of research articles have been published on the practice of performance appraisals. Most researchers find that such appraisals are exceedingly noisy. This sobering conclusion comes mostly from studies based on 360-degree performance reviews, in which multiple raters provide input on the same person being rated, usually on multiple dimensions of performance. When this analysis is conducted, the result is not pretty. Studies often find that true variance, that is, variance attributable to the person's performance, accounts for no more than 20 to 30% of the total variance. The rest, 70 to 80% of the variance in the ratings, is system noise. Where does this noise come from? Thanks to multiple studies of variance in job performance ratings, we know that all the components of system noise are present. These components are quite easy to picture in the context of a performance rating. Consider two raters, Lynn and Mary. If Lynn is lenient and Mary tough, in the sense that Lynn gives higher ratings than Mary does on average to all people being evaluated, then we have level noise. As noted in our discussion of judges, this noise may mean either that Lynn and Mary form truly different impressions, or that the two raters merely use the rating scale differently to express the same impression. Now, if Lynn is evaluating you and happens to have a distinctly poor opinion of you and your contributions, her general leniency may be offset by her idiosyncratic and negative reaction to you. This is what we have called a stable pattern. A specific rater's reaction to a specific person being rated. Because the pattern is unique to Lynn and to her judgment of you, it is a source of pattern noise. Finally, Mary may have discovered that someone dented her car in the parking lot just before she filled in a rating form. Or Lynn may have just received her own surprisingly generous bonus, which put her in an unusually good mood as she evaluated your performance. Such events may, of course, produce occasion noise. Different studies come to different conclusions on the breakdown of system noise into these three components: level, pattern, and occasion. And we can certainly imagine reasons why it should vary from one organization to the next. But all forms of noise are undesirable. The basic message that emerges from this research is a simple one. Most ratings of performance have much less to do with the performance of the person being rated than we would wish. As one review summarizes it, the relationship between job performance and ratings of job performance is likely to be weak or, at best, uncertain. In addition, there are many reasons why ratings in organizations might not reflect the rater's perception of an employee's true performance. For example, raters might not, in fact, attempt to evaluate performance accurately, but might rate people strategically. Among other motives, the evaluators might intentionally inflate a rating to avoid a difficult feedback conversation, to favor a person who is seeking a long-awaited promotion, or even, paradoxically, to get rid of an underperforming team member who needs a good evaluation to be allowed to transfer to another division. These strategic calculations certainly affect ratings, but they are not the only source of noise. We know this thanks to a sort of natural experiment. Some 360-degree feedback systems are used solely for developmental purposes. With these systems, the respondents are told that the feedback will not be used for evaluation purposes. To the extent that the raters actually believe what they are told, this approach discourages them from inflating or deflating ratings. As it turns out, the developmental review does make a difference in the quality of the feedback, but system noise remains high and still accounts for much more variance than does the performance of the person being rated. Even when the feedback is purely developmental, ratings remain noisy. A problem long recognized, but not solved. If performance rating systems are so badly broken, the people who measure performance should take notice and improve them. Indeed, over the past several decades, organizations have experimented with countless reforms to those systems. The reforms have employed some of the noise reduction strategies we have outlined. In our view, much more could be done. Almost all organizations use the noise reduction strategy of aggregation. Aggregate ratings are often associated with 360-degree rating systems, which became the standard in large corporations in the 1990s. The journal Human Resources Management had a special issue on 360-degree feedback in 1993. While averaging ratings from several raters should help to reduce system noise, it is worth noting that 360-degree feedback systems were not invented as a remedy for that problem. Their primary purpose is to measure much more than what a boss sees. When your peers and subordinates, and not just your boss, are asked to contribute to your performance evaluation, the nature of what is valued is changed. The theory is that this shift is for the better because today's jobs entail more than pleasing your boss. The rise in popularity of 360-degree feedback coincided with the generalization of fluid, project-based organizations. Some evidence suggests that 360-degree feedback is a useful tool in that it predicts objectively measurable performance. Unfortunately, the use of this feedback system has created its own problems. As computerization made it effortless to add more questions to feedback systems, and as the proliferation of multiple corporate objectives and constraints added dimensions to job descriptions, many feedback questionnaires became absurdly complex. Over-engineered questionnaires abound. One example involves 46 ratings on 11 dimensions for each rater and person being rated. It would take a superhuman rater to recall and process accurate, relevant facts about numerous people being evaluated on so many dimensions. In some ways, this overly complicated approach is not only useless but also pernicious. As we have seen, the halo effect implies that supposedly separate dimensions will, in fact, not be treated separately. A strong positive or negative rating on one of the first questions will tend to pull answers to subsequent questions in the same direction. Even more importantly, the development of 360-degree systems has exponentially increased the amount of time devoted to providing feedback. It is not uncommon for middle managers to be asked to complete dozens of questionnaires on their colleagues at all levels, and sometimes on their counterparts in other organizations, because many companies now request feedback from customers, vendors, and other business partners. However well-intentioned, this explosion in the demands placed on time-constrained raters cannot be expected to improve the quality of the information they supply. In this case, the reduction of noise may not be worth the cost, a problem that we will discuss in Part 6. Finally, 360-degree systems are not immune to a near-universal disease of all performance measurement systems: creeping ratings inflation. One large industrial company once observed that 98% of its managers had been rated as fully meeting expectations. When almost everyone receives the highest possible rating, it is fair to question the value of these ratings. In praise of relative judgments. A theoretically effective solution to the problem of ratings inflation is to introduce some standardization in ratings. One popular practice that aims to do this is forced ranking. In a forced ranking system, raters are not only prevented from giving everyone the highest possible rating, but also forced to abide by a predetermined distribution. Forced ranking was advocated by Jack Welch when he was CEO of General Electric, as a way to stop inflation in ratings and to ensure candor in performance reviews. Many companies adopted it only to abandon it later, citing undesirable side effects on morale and teamwork. Whatever their flaws, rankings are less noisy than ratings. We saw in the example of punitive damages that there is much less noise in relative judgments than in absolute ones, and this relationship has been shown to apply in performance ratings too. To appreciate why, consider two different scales for evaluating employees. Scale A, in which an employee is rated on an absolute scale, requires what we have called a matching operation: finding the score that most clearly matches your impression of each employee's work quality. Scale B, by contrast, requires each individual to be compared with a group of others on a specific dimension. The supervisor is asked to state the rank, or percentile, of an employee in a specified population using a percentile scale. The approach in Scale B has two advantages. First, rating all employees on one dimension at a time exemplifies a noise reduction strategy we will discuss in more detail in the next chapter, structuring a complex judgment into several dimensions. Structuring is an attempt to limit the halo effect, which usually keeps the ratings of one individual on different dimensions within a small range. Structuring, of course, works only if the ranking is done on each dimension separately, as in this example. Ranking employees on an ill-defined aggregate judgment of work quality would not reduce the halo effect. Second, as we discussed in Chapter 15, a ranking reduces both pattern noise and level noise. You are less likely to be inconsistent and to create pattern noise when you compare the performance of two members of your team than when you separately give each one a grade. More importantly, rankings mechanically eliminate level noise. If Lynn and Mary are evaluating the same group of 20 employees, and Lynn is more lenient than Mary, their average ratings will be different, but their average rankings will not. A lenient ranker and a tough ranker use the same ranks. Indeed, noise reduction is the main stated objective of forced ranking, which ensures that all raters have the same mean and the same distribution of evaluations. Rankings are forced when a distribution of ratings is mandated. For instance, a rule might state that no more than 20% of the people being rated can be put in the top category, and that no less than 15% can be put in the bottom one. Rank, but do not force. In principle, therefore, forced ranking should bring about much-needed improvements. Yet it often backfires. We do not intend here to review all its possible unwanted effects, which are often related to poor implementation rather than principle. But two issues with forced ranking systems offer some general lessons. The first is the confusion between absolute and relative performance. It is certainly impossible for 98% of the managers of any company to be in the top 20%, 50%, or even 80% of their peer group. But it is not impossible that they all meet expectations if these expectations have been defined ex ante and in absolute terms. Many executives object to the notion that nearly all employees can meet expectations. If so, they argue, the expectations must be too low, perhaps because of a culture of complacency. Admittedly, this interpretation may be valid, but it is also possible that most employees really do meet high expectations. Indeed, this is exactly what we would expect to find in a high-performance organization. You would not sneer at the leniency of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration's performance management procedures if you heard that all the astronauts on a successful space mission have fully met expectations. The upshot is that a system that depends on relative evaluations is appropriate only if an organization cares about relative performance. For example, relative ratings might make sense when, regardless of people's absolute performance, only a fixed percentage of them can be promoted. Think of colonels being evaluated for promotion to general. But forcing a relative ranking on what purports to measure an absolute level of performance, as many companies do, is illogical. And mandating that a set percentage of employees be rated as failing to meet absolute expectations is not just cruel, it is absurd. It would be foolish to say that 10% of an elite unit of the Army must be graded unsatisfactory. The second problem is that the forced distribution of the ratings is assumed to reflect the distribution of the underlying true performances, typically something close to a normal distribution. Yet even if the distribution of performances in the population being rated is known, the same distribution may not be reproduced in a smaller group, such as those assessed by a single evaluator. If you randomly pick 10 people from a population of several thousand, there is no guarantee that exactly two of them will belong to the top 20% of the general population. No guarantee is an understatement. The probability that this will be the case is just 30%. In practice, the problem is even worse, because the composition of teams is not random. Some units may be staffed almost entirely with high performers, and others with subpar employees. Inevitably, forced ranking in such a setting is a source of error and unfairness. Suppose that one raider's team is composed of five people whose performances are indistinguishable. forcing a differentiated distribution of ratings on this undifferentiated reality does not reduce error, it increases it. Critics of forced ranking have often focused their attacks on the principle of ranking, which they decry as brutal, inhumane, and ultimately counterproductive. Whether or not you accept these arguments, the fatal flaw of forced ranking is not the ranking, but the forced. Whenever judgments are forced onto an inappropriate scale, either because a relative scale is used to measure an absolute performance, or because judges are forced to distinguish the indistinguishable, the choice of the scale mechanically adds noise. What's next? In light of all the efforts that organizations have made to improve performance measurement, it is an understatement to say that the results have been disappointing. As a result of those efforts, the cost of performance evaluations skyrocketed. In 2015, Deloitte calculated that it was spending 2 million hours each year evaluating its 65,000 people. Performance reviews continue to be one of the most dreaded rituals of organizations, hated almost as much by those who have to perform them as by those who receive them. One study found that a staggering 90% of managers, employees, and HR heads believe that their performance management processes fail to deliver the results they expected. Research has confirmed what most managers have experienced. Although performance feedback, when associated with a development plan for the employee, can bring about improvements, performance ratings, as they are most often practiced, demotivate as often as they motivate. As one review article summarized, no matter what has been tried over decades to improve performance management processes, they continue to generate inaccurate information and do virtually nothing to drive performance. In despair, a small but growing number of companies are now considering the radical option of eliminating evaluation systems altogether. Proponents of this performance management revolution, including many technology companies, some professional services organizations, and a handful of companies in traditional sectors, aim to focus on developmental, future-oriented feedback rather than on evaluative backward-looking assessment. A few have even made their evaluations numberless, which means that they abandon traditional performance ratings. For companies that are not giving up on performance ratings, and they are the overwhelming majority, what can be done to improve them? One noise reduction strategy has to do, again, with picking the right scale. The aim is to ensure a common frame of reference. Research suggests that a combination of improved rating formats and training of the raters can help achieve more consistency between raters in their use of the scale. At a minimum, performance rating scales must be anchored on descriptors that are sufficiently specific to be interpreted consistently. Many organizations use behaviorally anchored rating scales in which each degree on the scale corresponds to a description of specific behaviors. Evidence suggests, however, that behaviorally anchored rating scales are not sufficient to eliminate noise. A further step, frame of reference training, has been shown to help ensure consistency between raters. In this step, raters are trained to recognize different dimensions of performance. They practice rating performance using videotaped vignettes and then learn how their ratings compare with true ratings provided by experts. The performance vignettes act as reference cases. Each vignette defines an anchor point on the performance scale, which becomes a case scale. With a case scale, each rating of a new individual is a comparison with the anchor cases. It becomes a relative judgment. Because comparative judgments are less susceptible to noise than ratings are, case scales are more reliable than scales that use numbers, adjectives, or behavioral descriptions. Frame of reference training has been known for decades and provides demonstrably less noisy and more accurate ratings. Yet it has gained little ground. It is easy to guess why. Frame of reference training, case scales, and other tools that pursue the same goals are complex and time-consuming. To be valuable, they usually need to be customized for the company and even for the unit conducting the evaluations, and they must be frequently updated as job requirements evolve. These tools require a company to add to its already large investment in its performance management systems. Current fashion goes in the opposite direction. In Part 6, we shall have more to say about the costs of reducing noise. In addition, any organization that tames the noise attributable to raters also reduces their ability to influence ratings in pursuit of their own goals. Requiring managers to undergo additional rater training, to invest more effort in the rating process, and to give up some of the control they have over outcomes is certain to generate considerable resistance. Tellingly, the majority of studies of frame of reference rater training have so far been conducted on students, not on actual managers. The large subject of performance evaluation raises many questions, both practical and philosophical. Some people ask, for instance, to what extent the notion of individual performance is meaningful in today's organizations, where outcomes often depend on how people interact with one another. If we believe the notion is indeed meaningful, we must wonder how levels of individual performance are distributed among people in a given organization. For instance, whether performance follows a normal distribution or whether there exists star talent making a hugely disproportionate contribution. And if your goal is to bring out the best in people, you can reasonably ask whether measuring individual performance and using that measurement to motivate people through fear and greed is the best approach, or even an effective one. If you are designing or revising a performance management system, you will need to answer these questions and many more. Our aspiration here is not to examine these questions, but to make a more modest suggestion. If you do measure performance, your performance ratings have probably been pervaded by system noise, and for that reason, they might be essentially useless and quite possibly counterproductive. Reducing this noise is a challenge that cannot be solved by simple technological fixes. It requires clear thinking about the judgments that raters are expected to make. Most likely, you will find that you can improve judgments by clarifying the rating scale and training people to use it consistently. This noise reduction strategy is applicable in many other fields. Speaking of defining the scale, we spend a lot of time on our performance ratings, and yet the results are one quarter performance and three quarters system noise. We tried 360-degree feedback and forced ranking to address this problem, but we may have made things worse. If there is so much level noise, it is because different raters have completely different ideas of what good or great means. They will only agree if we give them concrete cases as anchors on the rating scale. Chapter 24. Structure in Hiring. If you have ever held a job of any kind, the words recruiting interview might evoke some vivid and stressful memories. Job interviews in which a candidate meets with a future supervisor or an HR professional are a rite of passage required to enter many organizations. In most cases, interviews follow a well-rehearsed routine. After exchanging some pleasantries, interviewers ask candidates to describe their experience or elaborate on specific aspects of it. Questions are asked about achievements and challenges, motivations for the job, or improvement ideas for the company. Often the interviewers ask candidates to describe their personality and explain why they would be a good fit for the position or the company's culture. Hobbies and interests are sometimes discussed. Toward the end, the candidate usually gets to ask a few questions which are duly evaluated for relevance and insightfulness. If you are now in a position to hire employees, your selection methods probably include some version of this ritual. As one organizational psychologist noted, it is rare, even unthinkable, for someone to be hired without some type of interview, and almost all professionals rely to some degree on their intuitive judgments when making hiring decisions in these interviews. The ubiquity of the employment interview reflects a deep-seated belief in the value of judgment when it comes to choosing the people we will work with. And as a judgment task, personnel selection has a great advantage. Because it is so ubiquitous and so important, organizational psychologists have studied it in great detail. The inaugural issue of the Journal of Applied Psychology, published in 1917, identified hiring as the supreme problem, because human capacities are, after all, the chief national resources. A century later, we know a lot about the effectiveness of various selection techniques, including standard interviews. No complex judgment task has been the focus of so much field research. This makes it a perfect test case, offering lessons that can be extrapolated to many judgments involving a choice among several options. The dangers of interviews. If you are unfamiliar with research on the employment interview, what follows may surprise you. In essence, if your goal is to determine which candidates will succeed in a job and which will fail, standard interviews, also called unstructured interviews to distinguish them from structured interviews to which we will turn shortly, are not very informative. To put it more starkly, they are often useless. To reach this conclusion, innumerable studies estimated the correlation between the rating an evaluator gives a candidate after an interview and the candidate's eventual success on the job. If the correlation between the interview rating and success is high, then interviews or any other recruiting techniques for which correlation is computed in the same manner can be assumed to be a good predictor of how candidates will perform. A caveat is needed here. The definition of success is a non-trivial problem. Typically, performance is evaluated on the basis of supervisor ratings. Sometimes the metric is length of employment. Such measures raise questions, of course, especially given the questionable validity of performance ratings, which we noted in the previous chapter. However, for the purpose of evaluating the quality of an employer's judgments when selecting employees, it seems reasonable to use the judgments that the same employer makes when evaluating the employees thus hired. Any analysis of the quality of hiring decisions must make this assumption. So, what do these analyses conclude? In Chapter 11, we mentioned a correlation between typical interview ratings and job performance ratings of 0.28. Other studies report correlations that range between 0.2 and 0.33. As we have seen, this is a very good correlation by social science standards, but not a very good one on which to base your decisions. Using the percent concordant, PC, we introduced in Part 3, we can calculate a probability. Given the preceding levels of correlation, if all you know about the two candidates is that one appeared better than the other in the interview, the chances that this candidate will indeed perform better are about 56 to 61%. Somewhat better than flipping a coin, for sure, but hardly a fail-safe way to make important decisions. Admittedly, interviews serve other purposes besides making a judgment about a candidate. Notably, they provide an opportunity to sell the company to promising candidates and to start building rapport with future colleagues. Yet from the perspective of an organization that invests time and effort in talent selection, the main purpose of interviews is clearly one of selection. And at that task, they are not exactly a terrific success. Noise in interviewing. We can easily see why traditional interviews produce error in their prediction of job performance. Some of this error has to do with what we have termed objective ignorance, see Chapter 11. Job performance depends on many things, including how quickly the person you hire adjusts to her new position or how various life events affect her work. Much of this is unpredictable at the time of hiring. This uncertainty limits the predictive validity of interviews and, indeed, any other personnel selection technique. Interviews are also a minefield of psychological biases. In recent years, people have become well aware that interviewers tend, often unintentionally, to favor candidates who are culturally similar to them or with whom they have something in common, including gender, race, and educational background. Many companies now recognize the risks posed by biases and try to address them through specific training of recruiting professionals and other employees. Other biases have also been known for decades. For instance, physical appearance plays a large part in the evaluation of candidates, even for positions where it should matter little or not at all. Such biases are shared by all or most recruiters, and, when applied to a given candidate, will thus tend to produce a shared error, a positive or negative bias in the candidate's evaluation. You will not be surprised to hear that there is noise as well. Different interviewers respond differently to the same candidate and reach different conclusions. Measures of the correlation between the ratings that two interviewers produce after interviewing the same candidate range between 0.37 and 0.44. PC equals 62 to 65%. One reason is that the candidate may not behave in exactly the same way with different interviewers. But even in panel interviews, where several interviewers are exposed to the same interviewee behavior, the correlation between their ratings is far from perfect. One meta-analysis estimates a correlation of 0.74, PC equals 76%. This means that you and another interviewer, after seeing the same two candidates in